She was ready for the most joyous of sacrifices. Ferrante kissed Lilia. To protect the lovers, Roberto lowered a curtain of jealous transparence. The ship sailed away swiftly, Ferrante its master. In him she loved Roberto, into whose heart these images fell like sparks on a bundle of dry twigs. After fleeing the French shores, the Daphne's first port of call was Amsterdam. There, Ferrante, double spy that he was, could find someone able to give him information of a ship named the Amaryllis. Whatever that information was, a few days later he was in London looking for someone else. And the man to whom he addressed himself could only have been a villain of his own stamp, ready to betray those for whom he was betraying others. So Ferrante, having received from Lilia a diamond of great purity, was seen entering at night a pothouse, where he was welcomed by a creature of dubious sex, perhaps a former eunuch of the Turks. The eunuch recognized Ferrante as a brother in crime. He heard the question, saw the diamond, and betrayed his masters. In the center of the room stood a table, and on it was a basin covered with a bloodied cloth, to which the eunuch pointed with a look of complicity. In fact, the eunuch was none other than he who had wounded Dr. Bird's dog. Every day, at the agreed time, this man, dipping into vitriol water the cloth steeped in the animal's blood, or holding the same cloth to the fire, had been transmitting to the Amaryllis the signals Bird awaited. The eunuch related everything about Bird's voyage and about the ports where he would surely have called. Ferrante, who truly knew little or nothing of the matter of longitudes, could not imagine that Mazarin had sent Roberto on that ship only to learn something that to him now seemed obvious. So he concluded that what Roberto was really meant to reveal to the Cardinal was the location of the Islands of Solomon. Ferrante believed the Daphne swifter than the Amaryllis, and thought he would easily overtake Bird's ship. It was the eunuch who suggested to him the method of proceeding without mistaking his course. It would suffice to wound another dog, and every day act upon a sample of its blood, as the eunuch did for the Amaryllis dog, and Ferrante would receive the same daily messages that Bird received. "I will sail at once," Ferrante said. "I have a far better dog on board." He took the eunuch onto the ship, and made sure that among the crew there was a barber expert in the practice of bloodletting and other similar chores. Descending into the hold, Ferrante chained Biscara to two stakes crossed obliquely, and grasping a knife, deeply cut the captain's hip. As Biscara moaned, the eunuch collected the dripping blood with the cloth he had put in a bucket. Then he explained to the barber how he should keep the wound open for all the duration of the voyage, not allowing the wounded man to die, but also not allowing the wound to heal. After this latest crime, Ferrante ordered the men to set sail for the Islands of Solomon. Having written this chapter, Roberto felt disgust and weariness, himself crushed by the labor of so many evil deeds. He no longer wanted to imagine the sequel, and instead he wrote an invocation to nature. He prayed that night, stealing everything from his view, bid his eyes close, that together with darkness, silence come. Roberto, who was sleeping, thus dreamed Ferrante's voyage as it continued, only he was dreaming it as a dream. A revelatory dream, I would say. It almost seems that Roberto, after his meditations on infinite worlds, no longer wanted to imagine a plot unfolding in the land of romances, but rather a real story in a real land, a land he also inhabited. Except that, as the island lay in the simple past, his story could take place in a not distant future, which could satisfy his desire for a space less confined than that to which his shipwreck had sentenced him. If he had begun the story by presenting a generic Ferrante, his rancor conceived for an offense never suffered, a Ferrante who now, unable to bear the sight of the other at Lilia's side, was taking his place, then, daring to recognize his darkest thoughts, Roberto would have admitted openly that Ferrante was himself. Then Roberto woke, soaked with sweat. "What?" he said to himself reproachfully. I succumbed to the temptation to live through Ferrante, and now I realize that it is Ferrante who has lived through me, that as I was moping, he was truly experiencing what I permitted him to experience. To cool his anger, he again set out early in the morning, rope around his loins and mask on his face, towards his world of coral. Reaching the edge of the reef, Roberto swam with his face submerged. Lost in his search, he allowed himself at one point to be attracted by a jewel that appeared to him in a crevasse. He removed his mask, arched his back, raised his legs vigorously, and forced himself towards the seabed. The thrust was excessive, and he tried to grasp the edge of a shelf. Just before closing his fingers around a crusted rock, he seemed to see a fat and sleepy eye open. At the same instant, he remembered Dr. Bird had spoken to him of a stone fish that lurks among the coral caverns to surprise any living creature with the venom of its scales. Too late. His hand had rested on the thing, and an intense pain shot through his arm to his shoulder. With a thrust of his trunk, he managed miraculously not to end up with his face and chest on top of the monster, but to arrest his momentum, he had to strike it with the mask. In the impact, the mask shattered, but he had to let go of it anyway. Pressing his feet against the rock below, he pushed himself up to the surface, while in the space of a few seconds, he saw the mask sink out of sight. His right hand and his entire forearm were swollen, his shoulder numb. He was afraid he might faint. He found the rope, and with great effort, gradually succeeded in pulling it, a little at a time, with one hand. He climbed the ladder and slumped to the deck. Though his eyes were clouded, he tried to examine the wound. It was no more than a scratch, but it must have been enough to allow the mortal substance to penetrate his veins. He lost consciousness. When he woke, his fever was raging, and he felt an intense thirst. He crawled below and reached stores where he drank greedily from a keg of water, but he felt his stomach contract. He fainted again, his face in his own vomit. During a night racked by fierce dreams, he attributed his sufferings to Ferrante, whom he now confused with the stone fish. Why did Ferrante want to block his way to the island and to the dove? Was this why he had set out in pursuit of Roberto? He could see himself lying there, and looking at another self, seated opposite him, beside a stove, dressed in a house robe, trying to decide if the hands he touched and the body he felt were his. But he no longer knew which of the two was awake and which asleep. The other, but which, at a certain point stood up, but he had to be the evil genius who was transforming Roberto's world into dream, for he already was no longer himself but Father Caspar. "You've come back," Roberto murmured, holding out his arms. But the priest did not answer or move. He looked at him. It was surely Father Caspar, but as if the sea, giving him up, had cleansed and rejuvenated him. His habit was unwrinkled and neat, and he spoke with a grim smile. "It is useless for you to defend yourself. Now the whole world has a single destination, and it is hell." He took Roberto's hand, raising him violently from where he lay, and dragged him through the Daphne into a room he had never discovered, its walls white. There Roberto saw a closed hearse with a circular eye on one side. Before the eye, on a grooved runner, was inserted a little wooden strip fitted with several eyes, all the same size, framing pieces of opaque glass. As the strip was moved along the groove, the eyes could be aligned with the eye of the box. Caspar opened the side of the box, allowing a glimpse of a great lamp on a tripod. When the lamp's wick was lit, a mirror projected the luminous rays into a pipe, a short spyglass whose terminal lens was that external eye. From here the rays passed through the glass of the strip, casting on the wall some colored images, which to Roberto seemed truly alive, so vivid and precise were they. In the first, a ship was approaching the rock, and he recognized it as the Daphne. From it, Ferrante descended, now freeing a chained man. All was clear. In the course of his voyaging, Ferrante had found Judas. As the legend assures us, he was to be found, imprisoned upon the open sea, to expiate his betrayal. "Thank you," Judas said to Ferrante, but to Roberto the voice surely came from the lips of Caspar. "From the time I was bound here until the ninth hour today, I have hoped to be able yet to atone for my sin. I thank you, brother." You have been here only a day, or even less, Parente said. But your sin was committed in the 33rd year after the birth of our Lord, and therefore 1,610 years ago. Aha, simple mind, Judas replied. It is surely 1,610 of your years since I was set on this rock, but it is not yet, and never will be, one day for me, because God has willed that my punishment consist in living always on Good Friday, to celebrate always and every day the passion of the man I betrayed. Parente said, But still this son of yours moves, and the day will come when you will enter your Saturday. Yes, and then it will be worse. I will have left my purgatory to enter my hell. My grief at the death I caused will not cease, but I will have lost the possibility, which still remains to me, of making what happened not happen. But how? You do not know that not far from here runs the antipodal meridian? Beyond that line, both in your world and in mine, lies the day before. If I, now freed, could cross that line, I would be in my Holy Thursday, for this scapula, this badge of affliction that you see on my back, is the bond that requires my son to accompany me like my shadow. It guarantees that wherever I go, all time has the duration of mine. I could then reach Jerusalem, traveling through a very long Thursday, and I could arrive there before the completion of my wickedness, and I would save my master from his fate. Parente objected. If you prevent the passion, then there will never be the redemption, and the world will still be stained by original sin.
Aye! Judas shouted, crying. I was thinking only of myself. But what must I do then? If I continue to let myself act as I acted, I remain damned. If I amend my error, I confound the plan of God and will be punished by damnation. Was it then written from the beginning that I was damned to be damned?
The procession of images went dark as the oil of the lamp was consumed. Father Caspar was speaking again in a voice Roberto no longer recognized as his. The scant light now came from a fissure in the wall and illuminated only half of the priest's face. The one eye exposed to the light seemed also in shadow, but Roberto realized only then that it was covered by a black patch.
Ferrante, he cried.
In person, my dear brother. I, who, as you were struggling to swim like a dog, found my ship again on the far side of the island, and sailed through my long Thursday towards Jerusalem, found the other Judas on the verge of betraying, and hanged him from a fig tree. I prevented him from handing over the Son of Man to the sons of darkness, entered the Garden of Olives with my men, and abducted our Lord, stealing him from Calvary. And now you, I, all of us, are living in a world that has never been redeemed. But Christ? Where is Christ now? Have you not yet understood? For 1,610 years, Christ has been prisoner on the island, whence he tries to escape in the form of an orange dove. But he is unable to abandon that place, where next to the Maltese mirror I have left Judas's scapula, and where it is therefore forever the same day. Now, all I have to do is kill you, and live free in a world where remorse is banned, hell is certain for all, and where one day I shall be crowned the new Lucifer. And he drew a dirk, took a step towards Roberto to commit his final crime.
No, Roberto shouted, I will not allow it. I will kill you and free Christ. I can still wield my sword, but my father never taught you his secrets.
I have had only one father, one mother, your festered mind, Ferrante said with a sad smile. You taught me only to hate. Do you think you have given me a great gift, giving me life, so that in your land of romances I could embody suspicion? As long as you are alive, thinking for me what I must think, I will never cease to despise myself. So whether you kill me or I kill you, the end is the same. En garde! Roberto said, Yes, let us fight. It is fitting that one of us die. They climbed up on deck. Roberto hunted for his weapon and found it reduced to a stump. He remembered now. It had snapped off when he used it to pry a wardroom door from its hinges, but he shouted that God would give him strength, and good swordsmen can fight even with a broken blade. The two brothers confronted each other for the first time to begin their last conflict. The heavens were ready to abet the fratricide. A great concert of thunder and lightning erupted, followed by a downpour, and sky and sea deafened the duelers, dazzling their vision, striking their hands with icy water. But the two darted here and there among the thunderbolts that rained around them, attacking each other with blows and side cuts, suddenly falling back, clutching a hawser, almost flying to avoid a thrust, hurling abuse, cadencing every attack with a cry among the equal cries of the wind howling around them. On that slippery decline, Roberto was fighting so that Christ could be nailed to the cross, and he invoked divine aid. Ferrante, to prevent Christ's suffering, invoked the names of all the devils. Roberto pretended to fall. The other rushed to finish him off. Roberto, leaning on his right hand, thrust the broken sword at his opponent's chest. He did not spring up with the agility of Saint-Savin, but Ferrante at this point had accumulated too much impetus and could not avoid being stuck, or rather, impaling himself at his sternum on the stump of the blade. Roberto choked on the blood that poured from the mouth of his enemy in death. He tasted blood in his mouth, and probably in his delirium he had bitten his tongue. Now he was swimming in that blood, which spread from the ship to the island. He did not want to advance for fear of the stonefish, but he had completed only the first part of his mission. Christ was waiting on the island to shed his blood, and Roberto was now his sole messiah. What was he doing now in his dream? With Ferrante's dirk he had begun tearing a sail into long strips, which he then knotted together with the help of ropes. On the lower deck he had captured, using thongs, the hardiest of the cranes, or storks, or whatever they might be, and he was now binding them by their legs as coursers to that flying carpet of his. With his aerial ship, he rose in flight towards the now attainable land. Under the specular melitensis, he found Judas's scapula and destroyed it. Having restored space to time, he saw descending upon him the dove. But it was natural, or rather supernatural, that the bird should now appear to him not orange but white. Yet it could not be a dove, for the dove is not suited to represent the second person of the Trinity. It was perhaps a pious pelican, as the Son of God must be. Roberto could not clearly see what bird was offered him as sweet topsail for his winged vessel. He only knew that he was flying upwards, and images followed one another as the mad phantoms would have it. They were now navigating in the direction of all the innumerable and infinite worlds, to every planet, to every star, so that on each, as if in a single moment, the redemption would be achieved. The first planet they reached was the pure moon, on a night illuminated by the Earth's midday. We will not have looked for coherence, I trust, in all I have narrated thus far, because we have been describing the nightmare of a man poisoned by a stonefish. But what I am preparing to narrate surpasses all our expectations. The mind, or the heart, of Roberto was ordering a sacrilegious metamorphosis. On the moon he now saw himself not with the Lord, but with the lady. Lilia, finally recovered from Ferrante, Roberto was receiving what his brother had stolen. He kissed her face with his eyes, contemplated her with his mouth, and their enamored tongues jested, jousting. Only then did Roberto, whose fever was perhaps abating, come to. How long had he been sick? Days? Weeks? Or had a storm in the meanwhile struck the ship? For how long had he so lost his sense of reality? The Daphne had become a different ship. The deck was dirty, and the casks, leaked, were coming apart. Some sails had unfurled and were torn, hanging from the arms like masks, winking and grinning among their rents. The birds complained, and Roberto hurried to feed them. Some were dead. Luckily, the plants, nourished by rain and air, had grown, and some had forced their way into the cages, offering pasture to many. For others, the insects had multiplied. The surviving animals had even procreated, and the few dead had been replaced by many living. The island remained unchanged, except that for Roberto, who had lost his mask, it had moved farther away, drawn by the currents. The reef, now that he knew it was defended by the stone fish, had become insuperable. Roberto could swim again, but only for the love of swimming, while keeping well away from the rocks. "So many deeds," Roberto said to himself, "only to learn that I am a zero. Indeed, more of a zero than I was at my arrival as derelict. The shipwreck shook me and led me to fight for life, but now I have nothing to fight for or to fight against. I am condemned to a long repose. I am here to contemplate not the void of spaces, but my own. And from it only ennui will come, sadness and despair. Soon not only I, but the Daphne itself will be no more, I and it reduced to fossil, like this coral." For the coral skull was still there on the deck. We will recall that from the coral, Roberto rescued a stone that appeared to him to be the skull of Father Caspar. The coral skull immune to universal wear, and so immune to death, it was the only living thing. This alien form gave new vigor to the thoughts of the castaway, who had been educated to discover new lands only through the telescope of the word. If the coral was a living thing, he said to himself, it was the only truly thinking being amid the general disorder of thought. And we, inhabitants of the great coral of the cosmos, believe the atom, which we still cannot see, to be full matter, whereas it too, like everything else, is but an embroidery of voids in the void. Absolute nothingness that spins from its own non-being the illusion of everything. So here I am illuding myself with the illusion of an illusion, I an illusion myself. I who was to lose everything happened on this vessel, lost in the Antipodes, only to realize that there was nothing to lose. But understanding this, do I not perhaps gain everything because I become the one thinking point at which the universe recognizes its own illusion? And yet if I think about it, does this not mean I have a soul? Oh, what a tangle. The all is made of nothing, and yet to understand it, we must have a soul, which, little as it may be, is not nothing. What am I? If I say I in the sense of Roberto della Griva, I say so inasmuch as I am the memory of all my past moments, the sum of everything I remember. If I say I in the sense of that something that is here at this moment, and is not the mainmast or the coral, then I am the sum of what I feel now. But what is it that I feel now? Is it the sum of those relations between presumed indivisibles that have been arranged in that system of relations in that special order that is my body? And so my soul is not, as Epicurus would have it, a matter composed of corpuscles finer than the others, a breath mixed with heat. It is the way in which these relations are felt as such. Does it think itself as I think me? Surely not. In nature, man perceives himself in quite a complex way, the animal a bit less. It is capable of appetite, for example, but not of remorse, and a plant feels itself growing, and surely it feels when it is cut, and perhaps even says I, but in a far more cloudy way than I do. If this is so, then stones also think. This stone, too, this coral, which actually is not stone, but was a vegetable or animal. But is it true, then, that the stone feels nothing but its stoniness? What would I feel if I were truly a stone? First of all, the movements of the atoms that compose me, that is, the stable vibration of the positions that the parts of my parts of my parts maintain among themselves. I would feel the hum of my stoning. But I could not say I, because to say I, there must be others, something else against which to oppose myself. In principle, the stone cannot know if there is anything outside itself. It hums. Its stoning is a stoning of stoning. Of the rest, it knows nothing. It is a world that worlds along on its own. Still, if I touch this coral, I feel that the surface has retained the sun's warmth on the exposed part, whereas the part that rested on the deck is colder. Now, in a warm body, the atoms move more furiously, and therefore this rock, if it feels movement, cannot help but feel in its interior a differentiation of movements. Thinking of himself as a stone, Roberto slowly exposed different sides of his body to the sun's rays, rolling across the deck until he came to a patch of shadow, as would have happened to the stone. Who knows, he asked himself. Perhaps in these motions the stone begins to have, if not the concept of place, at least the notion of part, certainly of change, because if it feels itself now hot above and cold below, and now vice versa, but in the second condition it has not remembered the first, then it will believe always that its interior movement is the same. But why, if it perceives itself, should it not have memory? Memory is a power of the soul, and however small the soul of the stone, it will have a proportionate memory. To have memory means to have a notion of before and after. The problem, therefore, is having a sense of time. If the parts of the stone are in motion, this motion will have a rhythm that, even if inaudible, will be like the sound of a clock. The stone is the clock of itself. Feeling oneself in motion means feeling one's own time beating. The earth, great stone in the sky, feels the time of its motion, the time of the respiration of its tides, and what it feels I see drawn on the starry vault. The earth feels the same time that I see. So the stone knows time, indeed it knows it before perceiving its own changes of temperature as movement in space. At this moment I feel the pleasure of being stone. The sun warms me. The wind makes acceptable this adjustment of my body. I have no intention of ceasing to be a stone. Why? Because I like it. However willing, I could will, and yet I do not. How much freer am I than a stone? As I have said before, Roberto did not have the makings of a philosopher. Having achieved this epiphany, he experienced once more an amorous apostasy. Since stones do not love, he sat up, again a loving man. But then he said to himself, if to the great sea of the great in soul substance we must all return, down below or up above, I will be united, identical with my lady. We will both be part and all of the same macrocosm. I will be she will be I. Is this not the deepest meaning of the myth of the hermaphrodite? Lilia and I, one body and one thought. But have I not foretold this event? For days, weeks, months, I have been making her live in a world that is all mine, even if through Ferrante. She has already thought of my thought. Perhaps conceiving romances means living through our own characters, making them live in our world, and delivering ourselves and our creatures to the minds of those to come, even when we will no longer be able to say, I. But if this is so, it is up to me alone to banish Ferrante from my own world, forever, to have his banishment governed by divine justice, and to create the conditions whereby I can be united with Lilia. Filled with renewed enthusiasm, Roberto decided to conceive the last chapter of his story. He did not know that, especially when their authors are now determined to die, stories often write themselves and go where they want to go. Roberto told himself how Ferrante, wandering from island to island and seeking more his pleasure than the correct course, refused to be instructed by the warnings evident in the signals the eunuch sent to Biscara's wound, and finally he lost all notion of where he was. The ship, meanwhile, sailed on. The inadequate provisions spoiled, the water began to stink. To keep the crew in ignorance, Ferrante decreed that each man go below only once a day to the hold, and in the darkness take the minimum supplies required for survival, and no one was to look around there. Lilia realized nothing, for she bore every torment with serenity and seemed to thrive on a drop of water and a crumb of biscuit, anxious for her beloved to succeed in his enterprise. As for Ferrante, insensitive to that love except for the pleasure he drew from it, he went on inciting his mariners, flashing images of wealth before the eyes of their greed. And so a blind man blinded by rancor led other blind men blinded by avidity, holding prisoner in his fetters a blind beauty. Still, many of the crew, in their great thirst, felt their gums begin to swell and cover their teeth. Their legs became spotted with abscesses, and their pestilential secretions rose even to their vital parts. So it was that, sailing below the 25th degree of latitude south, Ferrante had to face a mutiny. He quelled it, relying on a group of 5 corsairs, the most faithful, Andropod, Boride, Ordogne, Safar, and Asprando. And the mutineers were set adrift in the sloop with a few victuals. But in so doing, the Daphne had deprived itself of a means of rescue. "What does that matter?" Ferrante said. "Soon we will be in the place to which we are lured by our cursed hunger for gold." But the men remaining were too few to sail the ship. Nor did they wish to. Having lent a hand to their chief, they now considered themselves his equals. One of the 5 had spied on that mysterious young gentleman who came up on deck so rarely and discovered he was a woman. Then those cutthroats confronted Ferrante, demanding the passenger. It was fortunate Lilia did not hear Ferrante when, in a murmur, he assured the mutinous 5 that he would reach an agreement with them. Roberto could not permit Ferrante to carry out this final villainy. He then chose to have Neptune become enraged that mortals had traversed his domain without fear of his wrath. The storm set clouds against clouds, waters against waters, winds against winds. It was no longer a struggle of nature against the seamen, but a battle of the elements among themselves. The ship was immersed, stern and prow, and every time it dipped, it seemed to fly from the top of a tower. The poop sank until the gallery was swamped, and at the prow the waves were bent on engulfing the bowsprit. Andropod, who was trying to secure a sail, was torn from the yardarm and, plunging into the sea, struck Boride as he was pulling a hawser and broke his neck. The hull refused to obey Ordogne, the helmsman, while another gust abruptly tore away the mizzen topsail. Safar tried hard to furl the sails, urged on by Ferrante's curses, but he could not finish lashing the crow's nest before the ship swung around and its flank received 3 waves of such dimensions that Safar was washed overboard. The mainmast shattered and plunged into the sea, not without having first devastated the deck and crushed Asprando's skull. And finally the tiller broke to pieces, as with a wild blow it took the life of Ordogne. Now this wooden relic was without a crew, and the last rats poured overboard, falling into the water they wanted to escape. Ferrante drags Lilia up on deck. And what does he do? Experience has taught Roberto to have Ferrante bind her fast to a plank, allowing her to slip into the sea, trusting that not even the wild beasts of the deep will deny mercy to such beauty. After which, Ferrante seizes another piece of wood, preparing to tie it to himself, but at that moment, onto the deck, freed in some unknown fashion, his hands still chained together, more like a corpse than a living man, steps Biscarra. Biscarra, who throughout the voyage has remained like the dog on the Amaryllis, suffering in bonds as every day they reopen that wound which is then briefly treated. Biscarra, who has passed these months with a single thought, to avenge himself upon Ferrante. Deus ex machina. Biscarra appears suddenly behind Ferrante. The officer raises his arms and brings them down before Ferrante's face, his chain making a noose at Ferrante's throat, and shouting, "With me to hell at last!" Biscarra is seen giving such a tug at Ferrante's neck that it breaks as the tongue protrudes between those blasphemous lips and accompanies the final rage. Then the lifeless body of the executed man, falling, drags after it like a cloak the still living body of his executioner, who, victorious, meets the warring waves with peace finally in his heart. Roberto could not imagine Lilia's feelings at that sight. The truth is, he was so fully occupied by the duty to send Ferrante to his proper punishment, resolving to follow his fate into the next world, that he left Lilia in the vast upheaval. The lifeless body of Ferrante had meanwhile been cast up on a desert island. Immediately beyond the beach, with no trees or bushes to mark its end, a plain could be seen, Where the plane began to rise, Ferranti could make out a little band of men, and he moved towards them. Men, or in any case human beings, they seemed from the distance. But as Ferranti reached them, he saw that if they had once been human, now they had become exhibits for an anatomy theatre. The first was a body without skin, the ropes of muscle taut, the arms in a gesture of abandonment, the suffering face turned heavenward, all skull and cheekbones. The hands of the second had flayed skin hanging from its fingertips, barely attached like a glove, and the skin of the legs was rolled up to the knee like a supple boot. Nearby, a skeleton was leaning on a spade, perhaps to dig its grave, its eye sockets peering at the sky, a grimace on the crooked arc of the teeth, the left hand held out as if to beg for compassion and a hearing. Another skeleton bent forward, proffered the curved back of its spine, walking in jerks, bony hands over a lowered face. The bodies stood in great and painful silence. The last of them held up in his right hand, his still bleeding skin, limp as an unused cape. It was possible yet to recognize a face there, with the holes of the eyes and nostrils and the cavern of the mouth, which seemed the ultimate melting of a wax mask, dripping, exposed to sudden heat. And that man, or rather the toothless and deformed mouth of his skin, spoke to Ferranti. "Ill come to the land of the dead, which we call Insula Visalia. Soon you too will follow our fate, but you must not believe that we all pass with the rapidity granted by the grave. According to our punishment, each of us is led to a stage of disintegration all his own, as if to allow us to savor extinction, which for each of us would be the greatest joy. Oh, what the bliss to imagine ourselves as brains that would turn to pulp at a bare touch, fats liquefying. But now, as you see us, we have come, each to his present state without being aware of it, through imperceptible mutation, during which every fiber of our being has been worn away in the course of thousands of thousands of thousands of years. And no one knows the extreme point to which it is decreed he must decay." "And God?" Ferranti asked. "Does God laugh?" "No, alas, because even humiliation would exalt us. How beautiful it would be if we could see at least a laughing God come to taunt us. What distraction, the spectacle of the Lord, who from his throne, among his saints, makes sport of us. No, God is not here. Here there is only a hope without goal."
"My God, a curse on all saints!" Ferranti wanted to shout in his villainy. "If I am damned, I must have the right to enact the spectacle of my fury."
But his body was spent, and the voice that came from his bosom faint. He could not even curse.
"You see," the skinned man said to him, his mouth unable to smile, "your punishment has already begun. Not even hatred is permitted any more. This island is the one place in the universe where pain is not allowed, where a listless hope cannot be distinguished from a bottomless boredom."
Roberto went on constructing Ferranti's end as he lay on the deck naked, for he had stripped himself for his imitation of a stone, and in the meanwhile the sun burned his face, chest, and legs, restoring to him the feverish warmth that had only recently left him. Now prepared to confuse not only his fiction with reality, but also the heat of his spirit with that of his body, he felt once more ablaze with love. And Lilia? What had happened to Lilia while Ferranti's cadaver sought out the Isle of the Dead? With a device not uncommon among poets, Roberto leaped over some events to find Lilia again some days later, clinging to that plank as it drifted over a now calm sea glittering in the sun, and she approached the eastern shore of the island of Solomon, that is to say, the side opposite the one off which the Daphne rode at anchor. There, as Roberto had learned from Father Caspar, the beaches were less friendly than those to the west. The plank, by now too fragile to withstand an impact, shattered against a rock. Lilia woke and clung to that rock as the fragments of her raft were lost among the currents. Now she was there, on a rock that could barely house her, as a stretch of water, but for her it was an ocean, separated her from the shore. Shaken by the typhoon, wasted by hunger, tormented even more by thirst, she could not drag herself from the rock to the sand, beyond which her vision blurred, she discerned the colors of vegetable forms. But the rock was searing beneath her tender thigh, and, hardly breathing, instead of cooling her inner blaze, she drew the burning air into herself. She hoped that not far away darting little streams would spring from shady cliffs, yet these dreams did not appease, but rather exacerbated her thirst. She wanted to ask help of heaven, but as her dried tongue cleaved to her palate, her voice could utter only abbreviated sighs. Roberto had allowed himself to be dazed by his wave-pounding exile, seeking always another self, dreadful in Ferrante, excellent in Lilia, through whose glory he had wanted to make himself glorious. But to love Lilia meant to want her as he himself was, both of them sentenced to the travail of time. Until now, he had used her beauty to foster the soiling of his mind. He had made her speak, putting into her mouth the words he wanted, words with which he was nevertheless discontent. Now he wanted her near, to love her suffering beauty, her wan voluptuousness, her bruised grace, her thin nakedness, to caress all eagerly, listening to her words, her own, not the ones he had lent her. He had to have her, dispossessing himself of himself. But it was too late to pay proper homage to his sick idol. On the other side of the island, in Lilia's veins, liquefied, flowing death. Was this any way to end a romance? Not only do romances arouse hatred, so that we may finally relish the defeat of those we hate, but also they invite compassion in order to lead us then to discover, when the danger is over, those we love. Roberto had never read a romance that ended so badly. But perhaps this romance was not yet finished, and there was a secret hero in store, capable of a feat conceivable only in the land of romances. Out of love, Roberto decided to perform that feat, entering the story himself. "If I had arrived at the island by now," he said to himself, "I could save her. It is only my indolence that has kept me here. Now we are both anchored in the sea, desiring the opposite shores of a single body of land. And yet not all is lost. I see her dying at this moment, but if at this same moment I were to reach the island, I would be there a day before she arrives, waiting for her, ready to rescue her, and what is more, Lilia, without realizing it, would sense a different love in my gaze, free of all lust, trembling with devotion." Is it possible he did not realize that Roberto was planning to land in reality on the island to rescue a woman who was arriving there only through his narrative? Having begun with the idea that the land of romances was completely separate from his own world, Roberto had finally come to make the two universes flow one into the other, and he had mingled their laws. So Roberto weighed means and ends, causes and effects, pros and cons. He had to abandon the idea of swimming to the reef and passing it. He could therefore reach the island only by repeating the course of the Daphne's longboat, that is, by swimming southward, following the shore at a distance, more or less at the Daphne's distance, then turning east once he had rounded the southern promontory, until he gained the inlet of which Father Caspar had spoken. Unfortunately, there were more possibilities of perishing in the attempt than of reaching land. He was seized by another idea, which immeasurably reduced for him the risk. Assume, then, that the current did carry him in the wrong direction. Well, but once he passed the other promontory, the current would bear him along the meridian. If he were to let himself float, his eyes staring at the sky, he would never again see the sun move. He would drift along that border that separates today from the day before, outside time, in an eternal noon. Stopping time for himself, He would arrest it also on the island, infinitely delay her death, because by now everything that happened to Lilia depended on his narrative decision. If he was suspended, the story of the island would be suspended. He felt as if this was the voyage of Lilia. It was the extraordinary vicissitude of Roberto that would guarantee also for her an immortality that the warp of longitudes would not otherwise have granted her. He would move northwards at a gentle and uniform speed. On his right and on his left, the days and nights would follow one another. Would he stop one day? From what he remembered of the maps, no other land save the islands of Solomon lay on that longitude, at least not until that meridian connected with all the others at the pole. But if a ship, with a following wind and a forest of sails, took months and months to travel a course like the one he was undertaking, how long would he last? Perhaps years before arriving at the place where he no longer knew what would become of day and night, or of the passing of centuries. But in the meanwhile, he would repose in a love so much refined that it would be careless of losing eyes, lips, and hands. The body would be drained of all lymph, blood, bile, and phlegm. Water would enter every pore. Penetrating the ears, it would varnish his brain with salt, would replace the vitreous humor of his eyes. At the same time, the sun's rays would nourish him with igneous particles, and this would dilute the liquid in a single dew of air and fire that by sympathetic force would be recalled upwards, and he, by now light and volatile, would rise and be united first with the spirits of the air, then with those of the sun. And the same would happen to her, in the steady light of that rock. She would expand like gold to airy thinness beat. Thus, in the course of days, they would be united in that understanding. Instant after instant, they would be to each other like the stiff twin compasses, each moving with the motion of its companion, one leaning when the other goes farther, to follow or to return together to the center. Then both would continue their journey in the present, straight towards the star awaiting them, their dust of atoms among the other corpuscles of the cosmos, a vortex among vortices, now eternal as the world because embroidered with void. Reconciled to their fate, because the motion of the earth carries evils and fears, but the trepidation of the spheres is innocent. He should not hesitate. Neither should he prepare for that triumphal sacrifice without observing the correct rites. Roberto entrusts to his papers the last actions he intends to make, and for the rest he leaves us to guess deeds, times, cadences. First he spent almost an hour removing a part of the grating that separated the upper deck from the lower. Then he went below and set about opening every cage. Thereupon he was struck by a general flapping of wings, and he had to defend himself, raising his arms before his face, but at the same time crying, "Shoo! Shoo!" He had to push some clucking hens, unable to find an egress on their own. When he climbed back up on deck, he saw the populous flight rise through the rigging, and it seemed to him that for a few seconds the sun was covered by all the colors of the rainbow, striped across their breadth by marine birds who had hastened, curious, to join in this festival. The birds freed, he flung into the sea all the clocks, not thinking for a moment that he was wasting valuable time. He was erasing time to favor a journey against time. Finally, to avert any cowardice in himself, he collected on deck, under the mainmast, logs, planks, empty casks, sprinkled them with the oil of all the lamps, and set fire to them. A first flame blazed up, which immediately licked at the sails and the rigging. When he was certain the fire was being fed by its own strength, he prepared for his farewell. He was still naked, as he had been since he began dying by turning himself to stone. Stripped even of the rope, which would no longer limit his voyage, he descended into the sea. He planted his feet against the wood, thrusting himself forward to move away from the Daphne, and after following the side to the stern, he left it forever. Before destiny and the waters decide for him, I hope that, pausing for breath every so often, he allows his eyes to move from the Daphne as he bids it farewell to the island. There, above the line traced by the treetops, his eyes now very sharp, he should see, rising in flight, like an arrow eager to strike the sun, the orange dove. Glory, glory. And what later happened to Roberto, I do not know or think it will ever be known. How can one draw a novel from a story so novelistic when the end, or for that matter the true beginning, is missing? Unless the story to be told is not that of Roberto, but of his papers, though here, too, all must be based on conjecture. If the papers, fragmentary in any case, from which I have devised a story or a series of intersecting or skewed stories, have come down to us, it is because the Daphne did not burn entirely. That much is obvious. Who knows, perhaps the fire barely singed the masts, then died out on that windless day, or else a few hours later a torrential rain fell and extinguished the blaze. How long was the Daphne there before someone found it and discovered Roberto's writings? I can venture two hypotheses, both fruit of the imagination. A few months before these events, in February 1643 to be exact, Abel Tasman set out from Batavia in August of 1642. After reaching Tasmania, seeing New Zealand only from a distance and heading for the Coconut Islands, he then proceeded north and discovered a series of little sand-girt islands. We will not go into the matter of their precise location here, but those islands, if my hypotheses are correct, should not have been far from the island of our story. Tasman ends his voyage, he says, in June, and hence before the Daphne could have arrived in those parts. But we cannot be sure that Tasman's diaries are reliable, and indeed the original no longer exists. Let us try to imagine, then, that through one of those fortuitous detours in which his voyage is so rich, he returned to the area, say, in September of that year, and discovered there the Daphne. No hope of repairing it, without sails and rigging, as it was by then, he inspected it to learn its origin and came upon Roberto's papers. Though his knowledge of Italian was poor, he realized that the papers included some discussion of the problem of longitudes, so they had to be considered highly secret, to be delivered only to the Dutch East India Company. Therefore, in his own diary, he says nothing about the matter, and perhaps falsifies the dates to eliminate traces of his adventure. Thus, Roberto's papers end up in some secret archive. Let us imagine the Dutch geographers leafing through those papers. As we know, there was nothing of interest to be found in them, except perhaps Dr. Bird's canine method, which, I am willing to bet, several spies must have ferreted out already from various sources. There is mention of the Specula Melitensis, but we must remember that after Tasman, 138 years had to go by before Cook rediscovered those islands. Then finally, and a century after our story, Harrison's invention of the marine chronometer puts an end to the frantic search for the Punto Fijo. The problem of longitude is no longer a problem, and some archivist of the company, eager to clear his cupboards, discards, gives away, or sells Roberto's papers. The second hypothesis is more like a novel, enthralling. In May of 1789, a fascinating character passes through those parts. He is Captain Bligh, whom the mutineers of the Bounty had loaded into a sloop with 18 loyal men, entrusting them to the mercy of the waves. That exceptional man, whatever his defects of character may have been, manages to sail more than 6,000 kilometers and land finally at Timor. In carrying out this enterprise, he skirts the Fiji archipelago and crosses the Yasawa group. This means that if he had deviated only slightly to the east, he could easily have landed somewhere around Tavuni, where I like to think our island can be found. Now, a man like Bligh, if he had found the Daphne in barely reasonable condition, arriving there in a mere sloop, would have done everything possible to put the vessel in shape. But by now almost a century and a half had passed. Some storms had further racked the hull, disanchored it, the ship had keeled over on the coral reef, or no, it had been caught by the current, drawn north, and flung on other shoals, or on the rocks of a nearby island, where it lay exposed to the work of time. Probably Bligh boarded a phantom vessel, its bulwarks encrusted with shells, green with seaweed, water stagnating in its riven hold. Perhaps, rickety, the quarterdeck survived, and in the captain's cabin, damp and rotting, but still legible, Bligh found Roberto's papers. These were no longer times of great anguish over longitudes, but perhaps he was attracted by the references, in an unknown language, to the islands of Solomon. Bligh could therefore have conceived the hope of having got his hands on a document that would proclaim him discoverer of the Islands of Solomon. I would imagine that first he mentally thanked Fletcher Christian and the other mutineers for having set him brutally on the road to glory. Then he decided, good patriot that he was, to keep quiet with everyone about his little detour eastward and his discovery, and to deliver the papers to the Admiralty in strictest confidence. But in this case, too, someone must have considered them of little interest, of no value as evidence, and, again, exiled the papers among bundles of erudite rubbish. Bligh gives up the Islands of Solomon, is content with being named Admiral for his other undeniable virtues as a navigator, and will die equally content, unaware that Hollywood will make him odious to all posterity. And so, if the narrative continued according to either one of my hypotheses, such an end would not be worthy of narration. It would leave everyone discontent and frustrated. In this way, Roberto's story would not inspire any moral lesson, and we would still be wondering why what happened to him happened to him. We would merely conclude that in life, things happen because they happen, and it is only in the land of romances that they seem to happen for some purpose. For if I had to draw a conclusion from it, I would go and rummage again among Roberto's papers to find a note dating surely from those nights when he still worried about a possible intruder. That evening, Roberto was looking yet again at the sky, and he realized that at La Griva, the heavenly vault appeared to him like the dome of the chapel, clearly defined by the brief circle of the horizon, with one or two constellations that he could identify. So while he knew that the spectacle changed from one week to the next, he never realized, since he went to sleep early, that it changed even in the course of the same night, and therefore that dome had always seemed to him stable and round, and consequently he conceived the universe as stable and round. At Casale, in the center of a plain, he saw that the sky was more vast than he had believed, but Padre Emanuele convinced him rather to imagine the stars as described by concepts than to look at those above his head. Now, spectator of the infinite expanse of an ocean, he saw a boundless horizon rise, and above his head he observed constellations never seen before. Here Roberto was a pioneer in an unknown land. Roberto did not simply gaze at the constellations. He was obliged to define them. He was alarmed that the whole was disposed as a spiral, a snail shell, a vortex. It is at this point that he recalls a church, quite new, seen in Rome, and this is the only time he allows us to imagine that he has visited that city. The church seemed to him very different both from the dome at La Griva and from the naves of the churches at Casale. Now he understood why. It was as if the vault of that church were an austral sky, which lured the eyes to essay ever new lines of flight, never resting on a central point. He realized now that the sensation of repose denied was something he had known first in Provence, then in Paris, where everyone he encountered somehow destroyed a certitude of his, each proposing a different map of the world, but the various proposals never cohered into a finite design. If the Creator consented to change his mind, did an order that he had imposed on the universe still exist? Perhaps he had imposed many from the beginning. Perhaps he was prepared to change them day by day. Perhaps a secret order existed, presiding over the constant change of orders, but we were destined never to discover it, but to follow instead the shifting play of those appearances of order that were reordered at every new experience. Then the story of Roberto della Griva would be merely the tale of an unhappy lover, condemned to live beneath an exaggerated sky, a man unable to reconcile himself to the idea that the earth wandered along an ellipse of which the sun was only one of the fires, which, as many will agree, is too little to make a story with a proper beginning and a proper end. Finally, if from this story I wanted to produce a novel, I would demonstrate once again that it is impossible to write except by making a partial story of a rediscovered manuscript. Nor could I elude the childish curiosity of the reader, who would want to know if Roberto really wrote the pages on which I have dwelt far too long. In all honesty, I would have to reply that it is not impossible that someone else wrote them, someone who wanted only to pretend to tell the truth. and thus I would lose all the effect of the novel, where, yes, you pretend to tell true things, but you must not admit seriously that you are pretending. I would not even know how to come up with the final event whereby these letters fell into the hands of him who presumably gave them to me, extracting them from a miscellany of other defaced and faded manuscripts. The author is unknown, I would, however, expect him to say. The writing is graceful, but as you see, it is discolored, and the pages are covered with water stains. As for the contents, from the little I have seen, they are mannered exercises. You know how they wrote in that century. People with no soul.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.